All right, now we begin again, and this is the second side. Mm. Now, we were talking a little bit about the independence of the Congo and it happening so quickly. In your dealing with Adula and Gazenga and some of the others, did you feel that they were ready to take on the responsibilities that they had been handed?
Well, I certainly didn't have that feeling about Gazenga. I thought he was a sort of a snake. Adula had a lot of respect for. One of the things that distinguished him from my mind was his span of attention. Uh-huh. I mean, he could have an object in mind and persist in it. Mm-hmm. And he did not seem to be force-fed with a lot of Marxist tags. He was not a man to divide up the wealth, because he said the wealth isn't big enough to divide it. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's his simplistic answer. The pie is not big enough for this due distribution. Mm-hmm. And he was a honorable fellow. Not totally. I suppose that Securities and Exchange Commission or somebody working on inside information would not approve it. Remember once we had, there was a question of what oil companies were going to operate, not only to market, but also to do a little exploration for oil, offshore particularly. Mm-hmm. And I was doing my bit for American companies. But to my utter surprise and totally out of the blue, the Italians got this, AGIP. Mm. Well, not without putting a lot of his friends and relatives on directorships.
What about Mobutu? Did you have any contact with him?
Oh, yes, of course.
And how was he to work with? Or did he seem competent?
Extremely competent. And he was a very modest fellow in those days. He was he had not become the grand mogul mm-hmm. at the present time, but he did have the army, and he had been in information office of the Belgians.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And he had military rank, but then he had the army. The triumvirate was Kazavubu was president, Adula was prime minister, and Mobutu was the whether he was called Minister of Defense or not, but he mm-hmm. was the chief of the army.
Right.
We had some missions with the army occasionally, green mission. He did develop a kind of ambivalence toward the UN, partly out of national jealousy. Mm-hmm. I mean, after a while, I mean, even if the UN is devoted to preserving the country against defection, still being done by foreigners, blue berets, and he would like to. Yeah. The army was there, but it was not what you'd call a highly disciplined force. Mm-hmm. I remember Godley saying to me once, the first night I was there, I decided to go for a walk, and of course I got lost. And the first fellow I ran into was this big Congolese soldier. So I went up to him and asked him where I was, and Godley was horrified. The last fellow he wanted to approach was somebody in uniform.
Well, that will lead into another question that I wanted to get to was, what was the situation of law and order in Leopoldville, where you were? You could speak from personal experience. And what were
well,
you in?
What crime it was what you'd call disorganized crime.
Uh-huh.
And it was.
Did you have to fear for your safety?
It's a hard question to ask. I mean, you took precautions against the kind of primitivism. You know, you were not. It was not. Actually the city of Leopoldville itself. The Nigerian contingent of the United Nations mm-hmm. provided a kind of police.
Uh-huh.
But there were times that you did not want to go into what was called the Belge, which was the sort of squatterville around the city.
Uh-huh.
There were areas that you had to be careful of. And there was a kind of a policy which I had, unfortunately, did not ever have to put into effect. But if you got into a hit-and-run accident, you were supposed to run because you had fear of being torn to pieces, whether you were at fault or not. I mean, and that might even be just a fender bender. But you, I mean, it was not, it was, you know, we had the walkie-talkies and we guard dogs and things. But you didn't somehow feel any of this as personal danger, I don't know. I remember this, well, the UN was a kind of a police force too in this respect. I remember they were very mad at the British one day. I forget what thing that the British made them mad. It could have been something.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a telephone call from the German ambassador. And he said, Ed, from the window, they're throwing the British ambassador out. they had the office building. So I looked out and I could see things going out the window from this thing. So what I thought I would do, I tried to get the... I forget what I did. Anyway, one element of police. But in the meantime, the UN had gotten to him. Then at the same time, they decided to go for the residence of the British ambassador.
So who was doing it?
Just mobs.
Oh, just mobs.
Just a mob.
They were, so the, they were...
I forget what it made
They were irritated.
I forget what had happened. I mean, just what the cause of this was. But, so they got to the residence of the British embassy and said, Mr. Ambassade Britannique. Oh, no, this is the embassy of the United Kingdom.
That was clever response.
The same Nigerian guard force that would walk along there, and they would leave notes at their different guard posts where they'd check in,
mm-hmm.
little pad, or the squad would write their notes.
Yeah.
And the British and the German ambassador had a small swimming pool there, and so he looked the next day after the patrol had been through and saw what the Nigerian had written. All quiet, inmates at water. Inmates at water. Cool.
Well, I wanted to also just ask you, in general, though, were the other Western nations, the ambassadors, supportive of the UN operation there? Did they generally cooperate?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, the Western ones did. I said with the different shadings that I've mentioned.
Right.
The,
yeah.
The French, for example, again, they were still they did not want to have the dissolution of the French Empire dictated by what the United Nations was doing there,
mm-hmm.
or what we did.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, though, and you see, there were not any great powers, so called, or weapon powers. The forces were purposely composed of less developed countries, the main force being Indian.
You're talking about the UN troops.
Yeah,
yeah.
Indian, mm-hmm. Pakistani.
Yeah.
They had been Ghanaians who didn't distinguish themselves, but little brutal Gurkhas at one stage, Irish at some time, Canadians, but more in staff and signals and hospital. But the UN, the Soviet Union, France, and not Germany,
mm-hmm.
but our role was to logistic.
Right.
And I think that mainly the embassies there, I were not entirely in the loop information wise. There's a book by Rosemary Higgins, I think it's written about those days. And
mm-hmm.
it seems to me she ascribes much more influence to the British than I think they had in this situation.
Oh, really? Well, I also wanted to ask you about the communications that were available to you. Did you feel that you had adequate communications between your embassy and Washington?
Oh, yes. Well, the reason is this. I mean, maybe Gabi would tell you about that, because the Timberlake, my predecessor, had a brother whom I also knew, General Timberlake in the Air Force. And it was told to me that with his equipment, he got aid. He got very up-to-date signals equipment, whatever we had in those days, cables, codes, machines. But commercially, as I said, the cable and wire that would have to be going through Brussels in that way. So we did a great deal of shortwave business communication.
Okay, so
and
radio
I spoke to Kennedy once or twice or three times through this.
Right.
And phone passed through a dentist in New York, as I recall it. And, you know, you'd get an amateur. Senator Dodd, who was thoroughly opposed to our policy, was always trying to circumvent it. You see, because the amateurs are only supposed to say, "How copy, old boy? I'm on a wavelength of something, and you and my frequent vibrator is oscillating or something." But to use this thing substantively, we did.
Either one of you can pour.
they could. I once. What would you like? Like any cream in this?
Maybe we'll just
compared to what everything that has happened since. It's curious that there was so much public attention to the Congo at that time. This was the big thing.
Right.
You know, now it's receded back to somewhere in somebody's memory. But it was the feature thing in the press for months and months, especially when the fighting was going on. But we had a very good press, and we didn't. We had no problems with the press at all.
Well, we were talking about communications, and I know that you weren't in the UN part of it, but by comparison, did the UN have a good communication between their headquarters in New York and?
They had communications, but it's interesting that you could bring this up. About two instances, two things. One, after this, next to the last round of fighting, Kennedy asked me to get Abdullah and Chambi together at Gatona. And he had sent a message to Abdullah for me to give him, which had I delivered it in that form would have kept Abdullah away. So I just deformed that communication and delivered my own kind of an invitation. But he had to be reached and gotten. That's one small example. But then when the fighting really broke out, two things pressed on communication. When Hammarskjöld's plane went down, the UN called me because what they needed was a bigger net. And so I used an indicator, just a priority kind of an indicator, which at that time, well, I don't think it's any secret now, but it had a secret name. But it had the effect of stopping everything, scrambling sack. My reason for doing this was that we needed everything immediately to try to find the Secretary General, because nobody knew who he was. And B, I wanted to get a head start on the Russians. I wanted this done at all. And I remember when I sent that message, a fellow came out of the code room, the communications man, his face was white, and he says, "It stopped." I said, "What stopped?" He says, "The world has stopped." "What do you mean?" I said, "Well," I said, this stills all communication. I mean, you stopped the world here." So I said, "Good God, I'll be court-martialed."
Nothing happened. I remember I got one little remark that you're not supposed to repeat that message to anywhere. I'd repeated it to Stockholm. But the UN
didn't have the capability.
Not of rallying it, not of moving it, even within their own country. I mean, sometimes I could use their net that was more advantageous for me. But generally, any communication out of the country, we were quicker and better.
Mm-hmm.
But so the more important part, when this fighting started, a lot of cold feet developed, as I say, in Belgium, UN, Washington. And there was a great fear that the fighting would cause the Kolwezi mines to be flooded, which did not bother me at all. So I didn't think they would be, but anyway. And that the fighting should be stopped somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were not to cross the Lufira River. Well, I knew that they'd already crossed the Lufira River.
Oh, they had already done that.
They had already crossed it. Premcha and Narayan suited me fine.
Mm-hmm.
But there was this panic, and we knew better. One of the reasons that I was in on that is that I had sent down our military attaché, and I put blueberry on him. That was breaking the sort of ground rules, implicit or explicit. I mean, we were not on the ground troops, but put blueberries on these fellows and sent them down. They had a lot of communication equipment with them.
Oh, I see.
So I could follow what was going on.
Right.
It was important to know. The other thing was airplanes.
Yeah, the U.S. provided air transportation.
By sea and air, the troops were there. And also during this, there was a crisis because there was talk of sending out American fighter planes. And we did send out transport planes, and they established these huge, big reservoirs for gasoline.
Mm.
Interesting things. They're just like a big above ground swimming pool, but of enormous dimensions. Contained fuel.
Mm.
And that scared the Congolese, everybody else, because they thought that we were coming in full scale to do this. But
that was to make sure that you had fuel for the aircraft.
Fuel for the aircraft, yeah. Mm-hmm. And actually what did happen was that some Cubans came down to supply some air cover. This was after the Hammarskjöld, they didn't know what happened. They thought it was shot down. Uh-huh. He wasn't shot down. And to this day, people think there was something conspiracy about it.
Well, as long as we're on that topic, from your information, what actually did happen, as far as you could tell?
Well, he appears not to have known that the fighting had gotten to the extent that it was. I was told until he got to Accra, I think it was. He was going to make a routine sort of.
Mm-hmm. He was on his way to visit Leopoldville, at any rate. Yeah,
that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Did
you meet with him in Leopoldville when he arrived that day? Yeah.
I did. And he and Linnert, Scandinavians in their white suits, trying to look very calm, although they were not. And he said to me, that he wanted to go down there, and he said I have to go back a little bit, and I tend to confuse the different rounds of fighting here. Yes, this was at the...
Yeah, in September when he came. Yeah, earlier
than
what
he
was talking about.
Mm-hmm. And he said he was going down there, and that he was going to try to mediate. And he said, I know what your government will say. I know that this will not be helpful to them. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I still don't. I don't see why he thought that was. I mean, but in any case, possibly because there had not been any communication with us about it, perhaps this decision he thought would take us by surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And all that worried him was whether or not his mission would be allowed to get off the ground, and that the Congolese Leopoldville might stop him. Just then somebody came from the Congolese government to give him the necessary go-ahead. But what he had done was to file, in the first place, he had chosen to fly with a Swedish crew, which was contract flying for the UN, and they had flown far over what are so-called minimums of pilots of endurance and fatigue. And he had filed a false flight plan, and they had.
Because they didn't want people
didn't
to know where
they were
going.
They didn't want to know where he was going, and also because, and this is important, that they, the French had supplied the Chambé with three Fuga Magistère training planes, but they were jet planes, but they could have shot down anything that the UN had.
Right,
they didn't have any armed planes. We even got some bombers out there later, but they wouldn't let them have any bombs. They're not our bombers, they were Italian, as I recall it. And the Italians later had a bad experience when they were, one of their transport planes went down and the survivors of the crew were eaten.
Yeah, I heard of that. But with Hammarskjöld's flight, then did they fly at night, or was the weather bad, or were there
No, it was at night. And if there's any, I think there was an error of some things I don't remember, other things I never went farther into. But as I recall it, that the control tower at Indol was not alerted or had gone off duty. And what the pilots did was to fly procedures, as they call them. You fly a certain length of time and certain distance at a certain height and come down and fly it another direction. And that's to help you to navigate in terrain. And apparently the pilot error, they flew it in the wrong direction at the wrong height and just ran into a mountain. And there was, Hammarskjöld had brought with him some UN guards, the sort of cops that are around the UN building in New York, and the UN guards. And they apparently had some live ammunition, which apparently exploded in a fire. And that's what made people think that there was assassination or something of that sort. Had the plane shot down as he was assassinated. It was not just a plane pilot error thing. So, but Linner was, they didn't know where the plane was. They thought that we could locate the plane. So I did get hold of the Supreme Command in Europe to assist in the search. And sent down our guys. It would come vaguely out of the head of communication.
Well, I wanted to ask you also some questions later on when the fighting broke out again, and we're talking now in December of 1961. You had organized a meeting of Adula and Chambé at Kitona. You mentioned that earlier. So I'd like to discuss that a little bit. Who initiated that meeting?
I did. I mean, you Kennedy did. I mean, it was so, but it was up to me to get it together.
All right.
And so, and then with the UN, and then a bunch came to it, and Chiari was there, and then a Frenchman, Monte, I don't know, their staff. And I went down to pick up in Chambé. In the president's plane.
Now, Chambé want to become involved in this meeting? Was he eager to for a ceasefire?
No, there was a first place. I had my own difficulties in getting Adula to go. I mean, I had to do whatever the terms of it was. I mean, it seemed to me that what he said, the way that Kennedy invited him, would have prejudiced what case Adula would make.
Now, you said you were having trouble reaching him. Where was he?
He was off in another province somewhere, and in this case, I was able to reach him through the UN.
Okay.
But it was more the terms in which to get him there.
I mean,
because he was constantly, Chambé was a very hard guy to pin down or to believe, and he was afraid of trickery on the thing. Chambé's thing, on the other hand, almost all night long in the guest house there at Indola, he came with his retinue. And he wanted to use this meeting as a meeting between states. He wanted to appear as the president of a country, an independent country.
Right. Well, just to back up a little a bit, you went down to Elizabethville in the plane to pick him up, though, and you brought
Indola to pick him up.
He was in Indola.
He went there. That was where to go to pick him up.
Was right. Okay. And so you picked him up in Indola and brought him to Kitona.
That's right. And he wanted to, as I said, he wanted this to be set up as one of the certain conditions he wanted to make. Among them, and the most important is the one that I recall, that he be there as the president of his country. And he also wanted a ceasefire.
So he was interested in a ceasefire.
He was interested in a ceasefire. But not prominently so, not to mean, what I detected was that his entourage was very, very nervous about this. Mm-hmm. And so and it gave me an idea. So he wanted a ceasefire, and he wanted everything called off and among the conditions. And I said, "Oh, I can't do that. I mean, I'm UN. I mean, this is its own body, and it's operating out of headquarters from New York." And I saw that had, his group was very frightened. I mean, they thought there was really going to be a big intensification of fighting. So I didn't know for sure that he would come. So I drove back into Salisbury. And the British High Commissioner was Lord Eaton, or some such name as that. And I remember his saying to me, "Well, don't be beastly to Shumby. We think you shouldn't be beastly to Shumby." I attention to beastly to him. I just wanted to deliver him. But in any case, I said, "You can do something for me. I'm not sure he's coming, and I'm not going to go out to the airfield field and be stood up. So I'm not going to leave the hotel here until he's passed a certain
road." So you know he's on his way.
If you can signal to me when he's actually done that, then I will go to the airport.
Right.
And so he was pretty exhausted when he got to the plane, so we gave him a beefsteak and put him to bed. And then when he came flying in there to Katona, which was a disused Belgian air base with a hospital building which we used at the meeting, he saw these troops. The UN had forgotten about security, believe it or not. And so at the last minute, knowing Shumby's fears about them, I said, what kind of a guard are you mounting down there? Oh, so they did, and there's some Nigerians.
Okay.
And they were digging foxholes around the building. And when we landed there, Shumby looked out there. "Quels troupes sont ceux-là?" I said, "Ce sont les Nigerians." He said, good. "They're much blacker." And what he meant by that is that he was apparently afraid of Ghanaians. And maybe the Ghanaians that he knew were not so black, but he thought he was going to be, that this was a trap that he was flying into. And then at one point during the negotiations, he wanted me to fly him to Brazzaville. And he wanted to quit, and I said, "Oh, I can't do that." I mean, and then I said, I think it's twice he wanted to be flown away from there. And the next excuse I used was, "Well, the airplane doesn't, we don't have a co-pilot. We don't have a co-pilot. If he's gone back to Sandyville, I mean, back to Elizabeth, Leopoldville, and we can't fly without a co-pilot."
Right.
And then it developed that the rumor came out that there was a troop of whatever, Congolese army, were coming up the road from the river, from the seaport, to get Shumby.
Oh, really?
And so we had the aircraft there, and we did have one pilot, and Bill Close, who was a Oxford Group Buckmanite physician, the father of Glenn Close, the actress.
Oh, really?
He turned out that he knew how to fly, so I put him in the plane, and he flew reconnaissance down to see whether the troops were coming up the road.
Okay.
He didn't find the troops. He said, "Anyway, if they were coming, it's underwater, so they couldn't get along if there are troops that way."
Uh-huh.
But then I'd also brought along a couple of Marine guards from the embassy, each of them about 7 feet tall, and they stood behind Shumby's chair. And he must have thought I had a whole lot of them because they rotated them. He didn't get the fact that there were only a few of them.
But that made him feel more secure.
That made him feel more secure.
Well, he had been arrested and held.
Bunch got this word. That's right. Bunch got the
and
word.
Now, Ralph Bunch was there also.
There. Bunch got the word that they were coming up there. So he said, "Well, let's come to my room. I just got some very, very important news." And his was the news that they were coming up the road to kill Shumby. And then the Marine was there, and he said, "Well, this UN ship is just offshore, over the horizon anyway, which we had brought there. It's a logistics ship." And the Marine said, there's a Marine company on board. And that gave me a lot of security. And I said, "Well, I mean, if they're coming up the road, we can get to the problem with that, we'll get that Marine company."
Right.
I only found out afterwards that there wasn't a Marine company.
So you had false confidence.
But then he Shumby, well, the reason I brought Close along, because I expected some stunt from Shumby, that's why I brought Close along. And Shumby at one stage retired to his room and said he had thick blood, real attack of thick blood. He wasn't going to play anymore. Mm-hmm. So Close went in to see him. And it was an impasse. And then Adula wanted to go home, and I had to chase Adula around the bushes to persuade him to stick around. It was either Chiari or this Frenchman, Monte, who found a formula. And that was that each of them would not exchange letters or agreements, but each of them would write similar letters to the UN.
All right.
And that would be the device whereby, well, all was great. And I remember on the plane flying home, I dictated this thing before I wrote it up when I got home. I don't know where the plane was that ever got there. But, of course, Shombi ducked out of that.
Right, right. Let's stop here so that we don't run out of tape.